week after. So I'll try to make this rather heavily technical subject somewhat interesting. But basically, you know, I've been thinking about this subject for about 40 years and discussing it with many of my colleagues, and I still am not clear that I understand completely the sociology of what... No, someone left a set of things from last year here. I don't know who left it. Last semester, right.
On the same subject?
No. Okay. So tonight I want to discuss the sturgeon and its various members of the same family. So let me briefly review what we covered last week. We first read the Ramban, and I will read him now in English translation, in Rabbi Chevelle's English translation. Snapir v'kas keses, fins and scales. This is just a review of what we did last week. Snapirim, these are what the fish swim with. Kas keses, these are the scales attached to the body of the fish. This is Rashi's language, and so it is also found in the Gemara of the Tractate Chulin. But you should not be led to understand from their language that these scales are really inflexibly fixed to the bodies and attached to the skin of the fish so that they do not come off at all. Rather, they are called fixed because they do not move to and fro from the fish, nor do they quiver as do the fins. They are the round coverings, the plates of which are like fingernails, and they can be removed from the skin of the fish by hand or knife. But those scales which are fixed and are attached to the skin of the fish and cannot be removed from the skin at all are not kaskeses, and the fish which has them is prohibited food. It is for this reason that the sages in the Gemara said that kaskeses is the cover of the fish. In the words of the Tosefta, the kaskasim are those objects which cover the fish, and the snapirim are those with which the fish moves. This is also the translation of Onkelos, who rendered the word kaskeses as klipin, which means literally shells, for they are like the shells of the fish, which can be taken off and peeled away like the bark of trees or the peel of fruits. Such is also the meaning of the verse stating, and he, Goliath, was clad with a coat of kaskasim. For their war coats were made of rings, and some people made scales in them in order to close up the openings of the rings so that thin arrows should not be able to penetrate them. And it was those scales that were called kaskasim. The sages also mentioned in the Gemara, dressed in coats of mail made with scales. Now Jonathan of Uziel translated in the above-mentioned verse concerning Goliath that he was clad with a coat of galdin, and this being of the expression, the razor of Hagalbin, which are the leather workers. By so translating, Jonathan thus intended to say that the covering of the openings of the rings in this coat of nail was like the scales of the skin of the fish, as they used to boil hard skin and cover the coats of armor with them, a practice they do to this day. Understand this. So the Ramban, in his Perush on the Torah, is telling us that in order to qualify as scales, they have to be removable by hand or by knife. On the other hand, we also read in the Ohel Moed, who is a contemporary, or came shortly after the Ramban, from the same small town of Girona, which only had 300 or so residents, so nothing that the Ramban did or said would not be known to the people in that community, and he writes, Hadag Shekarin Estarion, the fish that is called sturgeon, mutav, is permissible. V'yesh she'osrin oto, and some prohibit the sturgeon. V'haramban v'badko v'shara oto v'mayim rotchim, he investigated the sturgeon, did an actual experiment on a sample of the fish, and soaked it in boiling water, v'nishtayru mimenu kaskasim, and some scales fell off, hilchach mutav, v'gam rabbeinu tam matir. So whether or not his testimony about the position, you have a nosebleed?
Don't worry.
We have a doctor here.
He doesn't know. that's just
the weather.
Blue Cross, Blue Shield.
All right, so the testimony of the author of the Ohel Moed is completely 100% reliable as far as the Ramban is concerned. You may even question whether this fish, Esturion, is in fact a sturgeon, but that's the name of the fish in French, and it's the name of the fish to this day. And it is problematic as far as its scales are concerned, as we will remind ourselves in a moment. And certainly what the Ramban did as an experiment, namely he boiled the fish, soaked the fish in boiling water, and then had the scales came off, indicates that you don't merely have to be able to remove it by hand or with a knife easily, but you can apply some kind of a chemical procedure.
You said lye boiled it in lye.
No, the Ramban just used boiling water. Later, when we get to the Note of Yehuda, we'll see that he used lye. Okay. Excuse me? Sturgeon were obviously available since the Ramban tested. And yes, sturgeons are available in that region. Now remember, the problem with the sturgeon is, first of all, as we will encounter, is what is the definition of a scale? The current biology texts say that there are four types of scales: the placoid, the cosmoid, the ganoid, and the cycloid and sphenoid. And the typical fish that we're used to are cycloid and sphenoid scales. I passed out the pictures last week, not this week. They look different. Cycloid and sphenoid scales are found in the majority of bony fishes, the teleosteae. The anterior part of each scale is usually overlapped by the posterior portion of the scale in front. This arrangement of imbricate overlapping scales gives the fish greater flexibility than those species with cosmoid or ganoid scales. And I'm reminding you that I passed out pictures of these types of scales last week.
I have an extra one somewhere.
I will give you one.
I know, I can't find it.
Ganoid scales are found in fishes such as bichirs, bowfin, paddlefishes, gars, and sturgeon. Ganoid scales are usually rhomboid in shape and have articulating pedal socket joints between them. They are modified cosmoid scales, which consist of a bony basal layer, a layer of dentine, and an outer layer of ganonine, an inanic bone stool. And so first of all, the scales of the sturgeon are in fact different from the scales of other types of fish that we're used to. And perhaps also psychologically, the sturgeon has some properties which make it look drastically different from a normal fish. For example, on the first two pages of my handout, I'm showing you what the sturgeon has instead of a mouth.
That's the mouth?
Yes.
The
thing that's down there that you see on page 1 and on page 2 of this handout is a little tube that protrudes and acts sort of like a piece of a vacuum cleaner. The fish swims along the bottom and sucks up everything that's in the mud on the bottom. And
so what's the longest mouth?
That's his nose. That's the front of it. That fish is here. If you look into the second page, you can see that the mouth is not near the front of the head, but it's well behind the eyes. That's There's a man holding a sturgeon and pulling the Also, for psychological reasons, people might very well think that this is not really a real fish, but some kind of Sheretz Hayam instead of, or Sheretz Hamayim instead of a fish. So we can understand psychologically why there might be some objection. Those are little barbells, which allows it to feel where the bottom is. The little thing, it doesn't use its eyesight much. It floats along the bottom and needs to feel where the bottom is, like a blind man using a cane. And then where it feels where the bottom is, it protrudes its little tube, which it has instead of the mouth, and sucks up whatever live creatures there are on the bottom. And of course, they get to be quite big, the sturgeons, and they live to be quite long, some for over 100 years. As I pointed out last week, the name for a sturgeon in Polish is Chichuga. And we will use this when we get to the Chichuga and Marsham, because there's not going to be no question about the identification of the fish that he was describing. However, I don't know exactly what the name is in Hungary. Here, in a little thing that I downloaded from the web, they give the name Tuck. as the name of this fish. And certainly in the halakhic literature at the beginning of the 19th century, they mention both the shterel, which would be the sterlet, I would imagine, and the tick. I assume that the tick is the same as the tak. Are you aware of a fish named tick or tak in Hungarian?
No.
That doesn't strike you. But here it says definitely that the name of the how would you say it, a sterlet in Hungarian? They have sterlet. They were not regarded as kosher, but you have them. Okay. Okay, fine. Now, let me also point out that we don't know what contributions the Khazars made to the Jewish communities in Eastern Europe. Some claim that many of them, that the Jews of Poland and Eastern Europe, only a portion of them came from Germany, and many of them came from the Khazars, which were living in the Balkan area,
Crimea
also. And but we do know that the Khazars' economy was based to a large extent on the trade in sturgeon. They caught them and sold them, and caviar and so on. So that there's pretty clear evidence that had Judaism prohibited sturgeons, we would have heard of it in the time of the conversion of the Khazars to Judaism. So certainly there was a tradition in the Crimea and all areas radiated from that the sturgeon was a permissible fish. Yeah, primarily, that is all black caviar. The red caviar, it's called, that comes from salmon, but the black caviar comes from salmon.
Maybe that's why the Jews didn't eat it. It was probably expensive. Too expensive. Yeah, right. They didn't have books.
Right, now, so technically, this is a halachic problem, which presumably should be resolved like any other halachic problem, and I have no trouble declaring the fish non-kosher, as the OU does, or declaring the fish kosher, as, say, the Nod of Yehuda does, or the Marsham does, and so on. It's just, but for some reason or other, and I'm not 100% sure of the reasons for this, this became a tremendous flag issue at the beginning of the 19th century and at the end of the 18th century. This became a real flag issue, more or less like the existence or non-existence of the machitza as a flag issue between the conservatives and the Orthodox in the United States. So I'm going to spend some time trying to disentangle the history and the sociology of this. We will soon read the biographies of all the key players here, and I will get to that shortly. But first, I need to review some of the history of Hungary, and you'll check me if I'm incorrect, and then some of the history of Prague, and then we will spend some time reading a bit about the biography of each of the key players in this particular violent controversy. It was really a heavy-duty controversy.
I was so important.
No, it just faded away. That is, as you remember, here in the United States, until World War II, the sturgeon was a kosher fish and was the import. And after, but when the Hungarian Jews became more prominent in Orthodox circles, the sturgeon is no longer a kosher fish.
He was cousin of Rabbi in Hungary. I call tomorrow, and I find out the background he's teaching.
I will tell you all the background here. He probably does not know any more about it than I do.
I want the name of the sturgeon.
Tick. What is a fish? Tick. Okay. All right. So first of all, let me remind you that something that's very relevant today is that the Turks conquered Hungary in the 16th century. So let me read from the Encyclopedia Britannica in the
19th.
Yes, In the spring of 1526.
You were there
before my time.
In the spring of 1526 came the tidings that the Sultan Suleiman had quitted Constantinople at the head of a countless host to conquer Hungary. On the 28th of July, Petwaradyne, after valiant resistance, was blown into the air. The Diet, which had met at Buda in a hot haste, proclaimed the young king dictator, granted him unlimited subsidies, which there's no time to collect, and ordered a levée en masse on the entire male population, which could not possibly assemble within a given time. So the Turks conquered all of Hungary. The Turks had no sooner quitted the... But by the end of October, the last Turkish regular quitted Magyar soil because in the first invasion, he didn't want to stay, but somehow or other, the Hungarian government was completely incompetent at that time and couldn't live up to any agreements that they made, especially when these agreements were vetoed by the Catholic and the other churches. So therefore, the Hungarians reconquered Hungary in 1840 and then stayed there for quite a while. So the first thing we have to understand is this was Suleiman the Great, so there was a substantial Jewish migration from the Turkish regions, which meant in particular the Spanish Jews who fled to Turkey from Spain after the expulsion of Spain. Now let me read to you that's from the Encyclopedia Britannica. I will now read from the Jewish Encyclopedia, that is from the Encyclopedia Judaica. Hungary, Middle Ages to the Ottoman conquest. Archaeological evidence indicates the existence of Jews in Pannonia and Dacia, who came there in the wake of Roman legions. Jewish historical tradition, however, only mentions the Jews in Hungary from the second half of the 11th century, when Jews from Germany, Bohemia, and Moravia settled there. In 1092, at the Council of the Shabaks, the Church prohibited marriages between Jews and Christians, work on Christian festivals, and the purchase of slaves. King Coloman protected the Jews in his territory at the end of the 11th century when the remnants of the Crusader armies attempted to attack them. Jews resided only in towns ruled by bishops where important communities developed. In Buda, Prespor, that is Bratislava, Tirnau, and Esztergom by the middle of the 11th century. During the 12th century, the Jews of Hungary occupied important positions in economic life. The nobles felt it necessary to curb this development, and in the Golden Bull, 1222, an article was included which prohibited the Jews from holding certain offices and from receiving titles of nobility. The legal status of the Jews was settled by King Bela in a privilege of 1251, which followed a pattern of similar documents in neighboring countries. As a result of the Church Council of Buda in 1279, Jews were forbidden to lease land and compelled to wear the Jewish badge. In practice, these decrees were not applied strictly because of the king's objection. During the reign of Louis the Great, 1342-82, the hostile influence of the Church in Jewish affairs again predominated. The Black Death led to the first expulsion of Jews from Hungary in 1349. A general expulsion was agreed in 1360, but in about 1364, their return was authorized, though they were subjected to restrictions. I'll skip a little bit. In 1494, there was a blood libel in Turnau, and 16 Jews were burned at the stake. In its wake, anti-Jewish riots broke out in the town. These were repeated at the beginning of the 16th century in Prespor, Buda, and other towns. The economic situation of the Jews was also aggravated. Period of the Ottoman conquest. The first temporary Ottoman conquest of Buda in 1526 caused many of the Jewish inhabitants to join the retreating Turks. As a result of this movement, congregations of Hungarian Jews formed within the important communities of the Balkans. After Central Hungary was incorporated within the Ottoman Empire in 1541, the Jewish status was relatively satisfactory. Jewish settlement in Buda was renewed, and Sephardim of Asia Minor and Balkan origin also settled there. During the 17th century, Buda was one of the most important communities in the Ottoman Empire. This was largely due to the authority of its rabbi, Rabbi Ephraim Jacob HaKohen, the author of Shaar Ephraim. In the Habsburg dominions of Hungary in this period, hatred towards the Jews increased. In 1529, following a blood libel in Basel, 30 Jews were burned at the stake, and the others were expelled from the town. The Jews were also expelled from Pressburg, Ortenburg, and Tirnau. However, the magnates of Western Hungary accorded their protection to the Jews expelled from the towns. The Jews expelled from Vienna found refuge in the estate of Count Esterhazy in Eisenstadt and six small neighboring towns in 1670. It was the oldest of the seven communities, Siebengebirgen, of Burgenland, granted an autonomy and a privilege issued in 1690. And Transylvania, under the rule of Gabriel Rathan, the status of the Jews was stabilized by a privilege granted in 1623. The favorable attitude towards the Jews there stemmed from Reformation influences in Transylvania. Okay, now comes to the important period for us, 18th to 19th century. By the beginning of the 18th century, when most of Hungary came under Habsburg rule, only a few remnants of this ancient Jewish settlement were to be found there. At this time, however, a movement of Jewish migration began, marking the formation of Hungarian Jewry of the modern era. The census of 1735 enumerated 11,600 Jews. In reality, their number was far, far greater, of whom only a few were born in Hungary, while the majority had come from Moravia and the minority from Poland. Most of the Jews were peddlers and small tradesmen. Because of the hostility of the townsmen, most of them lived in the villages. During the reign of Maria Theresa, the situation of the Jews deteriorated. In 1744, an annual tolerance tax of 20,000 rubles was levied on them. It was gradually increased until it amounted to an annual sum of 160,000 guilders at the beginning of the 19th century. The reign of Joseph II brought some improvements. In 1783, the Jews were authorized to settle in royal cities. There were 81,000 Jews in Hungary in 1787. Okay, so the main thing that we have to remember is that the Jewish community, as it existed at the end of the 18th century and the impact throughout the 19th century, were immigrants. You have to think of the Jews in Hungary like you think of the Jews in the United States. That is, this was not a settled community, but their people came from various areas, mainly from Moravia and from Poland, and therefore you sort of had three communities, the two major communities of Jewish immigrants from Poland and Moravia, and then the small remnant of the Sephardic communities from the time of the Ottoman conquest. The fact that the Jews in Hungary were basically all immigrants accounts for a number of amazing facts, some of which have to do with the one really astounding fact of the predominance of Jewish Hungarian scientists in the first half of the 20th century. I mean, if one looks at the roster of Jewish mathematicians and physicists who all went to the same high school in Budapest, one can only be astounded. And part of this is explained in not this book, but a slightly different book by William O. McCagg, Jr., called Jewish Nobility and Geniuses in Hungary. And he tries to explain on various sociological grounds why it was that one or two small high schools in Budapest could produce so many astounding physicists like Wigner or von Neumann or Teller, or my professor, Wittner, and all others. And this has to do with the immigrant mentality coupled with the policies of the Habsburg Empire in the second half of the 19th century. Okay, so that's one piece of information. So we can understand that when you have a country of immigrants, especially ones coming from different groups, there can be violent disagreements when it comes to customs. The second community that I want to discuss is the city of Prague, because that also plays a key role. And here I have two, in my handout I gave you, by the way, I discovered in the course of preparing this shiur that the Jewish Encyclopedia, that is the 1905 edition of the Jewish Encyclopedia, is on the web. So you don't need to...
Really? The old one?
The old one. So we can... I have the old one in the living room, but it's falling apart. But now we don't have to worry about it.
Jewish Encyclopedia.
It's called JewishEncyclopedia.com, and I downloaded several articles from it for you. So first, I downloaded a whole long article on the Jews in Prague, in Prague from the old Jewish Encyclopedia, so I'm not going to read that. Instead, I will read from the new Encyclopedia Judaica about Prague. Unfortunately, my printer ran out of ink, so I couldn't print out enough copies of this. All right. Okay, so it's not part of the handout yet.
Okay.
Prague, capital of the Czech Republic. It has the oldest Jewish community in Bohemia and one of the oldest communities in Europe. For some time, the largest and most revered. Jews may have arrived in Prague in late Roman times, but the first document mentioning them is a report by Ibrahim ben Yaqub from about 970. This may be interpreted as showing that the Jews had either settled in Prague or carried on business there without necessarily settling permanently. The first definite evidence for the existence of a Jewish community in Prague dates from 1091. From an analysis of the medieval commerce in Prague, it is reasonable to assume that its beginnings date from about the middle of the 10th century. Jews arrived in Prague from both the east and the west around the same time. It is probably for this reason that two Jewish districts came into being there right at the beginning, one in the suburb of the Prague Castle and the other close to the second castle. The relatively favorable conditions in which the Jews first lived in Prague were disrupted at the time of the First Crusade in 1096. The Crusaders murdered many of the Jews in Prague, looted Jewish property, and forced many to accept baptism. During the siege of the Prague Castle in 1142, the oldest synagogue in Prague and the Jewish quarter below the castle were burned down, and Jews moved to the right bank of the river Moldau, which was to become the future Jewish quarter, and founded the Altschule, the old synagogue there. The importance of Jewish culture in Prague is evidenced by the work of the halachists there in the 11th to 13th century. The most celebrated was Isaac ben Moses of Vienna, the author of the Osirua, a native of Bohemia who spent part of his life in Prague. Since the Czech language was spoken by the Jews of Prague in the early Middle Ages, the halachic writings of that period also contain annotations in Czech. From the 13th to the 16th century, the Jews in Prague increasingly spoke German. At the time of the persecutions, which began at the end of the 11th century, the Jews of Prague, together with all the other Jews in Europe, lost their status as free people. So, I will not continue with the history of Prague, only to mention that it's important for us because the Rabbi Yehuda became the chief rabbi in Prague and served in the rabbinate there for quite a long time. And we have to understand that Prague, from the beginning of the 17th century until the first quarter of the 20th century, was certainly an important Jewish city, one of the perhaps most important in Europe. I need only remind you of the fact that Einstein went to the University of Prague at one of his first important appointments, and Kafka in the 20th century. But we're going to be concerned with Prague at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. Well, it's in the handout that I gave you, but for example, let me see if it says here. In 1522, there were 600 Jews in Prague, but by 1541, they neighbored about 1,200. I'm looking to see what it says. At the same time, the Jewish quarters were extended. So we know that in 1680, more than 3,000 Jews in Prague died of the Black Plague. And total population was somewhere around 10,000, probably 10,000 Jews.
10,000 Jews.
And the total population, I don't know, was somewhere about 60,000 would be more. Yeah, I'm not sure. Okay. All right. So much for a little bit of the history of the countries involved. Now I want to spend, before getting into the technicalities, a good bit of time on the personalities involved. But tonight, the key personality was the notable Yehuda. Did I pass that? Do you have some biography?
Yes.
Which one? Is it the Jewish Encyclopedia or the Encyclopedia Judaica?
Encyclopedia Judaica.
Great. Okay. So, let me first read from the Jewish Encyclopedia, then we will read from the Encyclopedia Judaica, then we'll read a little bit from McCagg's books. Remember, we met his widow. And then we will, I'll have some additional things to make. Landau, so I'm currently reading from What You Don't Have, which is from the Encyclopedia Judaica. A family name said to have been derived from the name of a city situated in Western Germany. The name is found largely among Polish Jews who probably were expelled from that city around the middle of the 16th century and retained the name in their new homes. The earliest bearer of it for whom there is a record is Yaakov Boch ben Yehuda Landau, the author of the ritual work Agur, who lived in Italy from about 1480 or 1490. And his was one of the first printed texts of halakhic codes. From the latter part of the 16th, and in fact the Beis Yosef wrote his own Beis Yosef and also the Shulchan Aruch because he was so dissatisfied with the production of the Agur, or rather disagreed with many of his decisions. Ezekiel ben Yehuda Landau, Polish rabbi, born in Apatow, October 8, 1713, died at Prague, April 29, 1793. He received his Talmudic education at Vladimir and Brody. From 1734 to 1745, he acted as first dayan of Brody. Maybe I should add here why he was forced to leave Brody. You don't find this in any of the history books, but you do see what happened from reading his Shavuot. Apparently, the wife of the official government-appointed rabbi of that district was very promiscuous. Scandal. If you read the details of the evidence against her and the various sexual relations she had with different men, you can see it all in the Shuv HaLenov Yehuda. It reads sort of like a pornographic novel with a lot of pretty gory details, and a person who had to deal with this case was the notable Yehuda, the chief dayan of Brody, but the chief rabbi's family, and especially her family, were extremely important people. So instead of enforcing a divorce, which was his decision, he was expelled from Brody and took on the certainly no less distinguished job as the chief rabbi of Prague. No, Prague was not an immigrant community. It was stable for 700 or 800 years. Okay. Or I'll read more now. So they don't tell you here why he had to leave Brody, but I told you why he had to leave Brody. In the latter years, he became rabbi of Yampo. Landau's tactful handling of the affair of the Eibschutz Amulets won for him general approbation. In a letter addressed to the rabbis who consulted him on the subject, he endeavored to persuade them to reach peace between the disputants and insinuated that the amulets may have been falsified. thus opening to the accused rabbi, accused an honorable way of exculpating himself. May I remind you of the scandal of... This, there are several scandals. You mentioned one, but this is the scandal having to do with the Bionis and Aishas. So let me remind you that there were several major crises in Judaism in the 17th and 18th century. First, of course, in the 17th century, you had the Shabtai Tzvi affair, which was a major crisis because he was a false messiah, and a lot of people believed in him, including some fairly respected rabbis. And then when he finally converted to Islam, this was a major crisis. And then, of course, that movement, the Sabbatean movement, went underground, so that there are people to this day who still believe in Shabtai Tzvi as the Mashiach. And a later manifestation, of course, of the Shabtai Tzvi incident was the incident with the Frankistin, with Jacob Frank and his followers. Frank lived from 1726 to 1791, and as McCagg points out in his book, many of the prominent Jewish families were, in fact, secret members of the Frankists. So that was a second problem. Then, of course, there was the general problem of the rise of rationalism and the precursors of the emancipation, that is, the general revolt of secularism against religion, which undoubtedly, at least at the margins, affected the Jewish community. Although, for example, someone like the Chagas Aryeh, who lived in Metz, the center of all of this turmoil, you can't see from his writings that he lived in an age any other than 300 years earlier or 900 years earlier. On the contrary, Rabbi Landau, the Notary Yehuda, was greatly involved in all of the events of the day and took care of it. Then, of course, as I just mentioned from here, there was the controversy of Yonis and Eichitz. Yonis and Eichitz was regarded as one of the leading Talmudists of the time, and he was accused by various sources, and then eventually principally by Rabbi Yaakov Emden, of being a hidden Shabtai Tzvinik, Sabbatean. And in particular, that he wrote various amulets, which if you deciphered them correctly, certainly indicated that the author was a secret Sabbatean. And as they mentioned here, from what I read to you, the Notary Yehuda suggested that, well, maybe these were forged and he didn't really write it, giving him a possible way out. And then, as Mr. Weinstein pointed out, there was the crisis of the Kliev get. And this was a get issued in Kliev by a husband who his family claimed was not mentally competent to issue this, and the rabbi of Kliev's stuck to his decision, and this became a big controversy amongst all the rabbis in Europe, because the rabbis in Frankfurt who wanted to impose their will and declare the get null and void, and the Notary Yehuda supported the rabbi in Kliev, and for this reason the community of Count Frankfurt said that he will never be a rabbi here. Okay. And then, of course, he thunders against the recitation of L'shem Yichud as done by the Hasidim, and applies to them the words of Hosea, a sort of substituting their in Hasidim proportion. Some years later, in a controversy between the rabbis of Frank and Amen and others concerning a form of divorce to be granted to a man from Kliev, Landau took issue against the former, and the so enraged them that in 1769 it was decided that neither Landau nor any of his sons should ever be elected to the rabbinate of Frankfurt. In the conflagration of 1773, Landau lost most of his manuscript. He was therefore induced to begin the publication of those of his works which the flames had spared and to add them to them his new productions. Landau's published works are Nota Yehuda, Responsa, Derush Hesped, a funeral oration on the death of Maria Theresa, in German, Sheva Fahuda Rasha, Mare Yechezkel, Notes of the Talmud, published by his son Samuel Landau, and Siyun Nefesh Chaya, novellae on different Talmudic treatises, and so on. Though a Talmudic scholar and a believer in the Kabbalah, yet Landau was broad-minded and not opposed to secular knowledge. He, however, objected to that culture which came from Berlin. He therefore opposed Mendelssohn's translation of the Pentateuch and the study of the sciences and languages advocated by Wesley. Landau was highly esteemed not only by his co-religious, but also by others, and stood in high favor with the government circles. So that's what it says in the Jewish Encyclopedia. Now, you say that we have also the Encyclopedia Judaica. I passed it out, I should have it. Yes, okay. Let's read what it says. This we can read together. This is from the Encyclopedia of Judea. Landau, Ezekiel ben Judah. So this is on my page 3, I guess. 1713 to 1793. Halachic authority of the 18th century. Known as the Note of Yehuda after one of his works. See below. When it says halachic authority of the 18th century, I would add that he was probably the last, or maybe the next to the last, of the halachic rabbis, who certainly was one of the great figures of the 18th century, who served before the creation of the Orthodox movement. In other words, you did not have anything like the Orthodox movement in the 18th century. This was something that came into being in the 19th century in response to a reform movement, and certainly the great rabbi of the 19th century, the Hassan Sofer, can't be called a traditional rabbi in the sense that he was already, if not part of the Orthodox movement, at least one of the creators of the sources of the Orthodox movement. So the attitudes of someone like the Chatam Sofer has to be categorized as Orthodox, whereas the Note of Yehuda is probably the last of the great rabbinic authorities in the pre-Orthodox days.
I understand. What was the Vilna Gaon?
The Vilna Gaon was not a Rav of the town.
He was around there. Wasn't
he? He was around at the time, certainly, and he was certainly admired and revered, but he was not a functioning rabbi. He wasn't Orthodox in any sense of the word, because the concept didn't exist.
And what was?
What do you mean?
Halacha.
There wasn't any such concept of Orthodox. They formed a movement in Hungary. It's something that was created in Hungary in the middle of the 19th century.
What is that something? Was there a quorum? Was there three?
This is a long story, and we won't get to it. That is, this is what we're going to learn tonight and next week is a precursor to the creation of the Orthodox movement, because this is an example of where strong ideological components entered into halachic decision-making. And people were judged not on the basis of the opinion they had in any particular special case, but on the question of whether they were really religious Jews or not. In other words, the whole idea of deciding a halacha based on what movement you belong to is a Hungarian invention, which came into play, right, around the 1860s, but as a result of the reform movement having taken place in Germany at the end of the 18th century and moving into Hungary, and one of the key players in the reform movement is a key player in our fifth story, and that is Aaron Chorin, and we will discuss him at length in a few minutes after we get finished with the Note of Yehuda. But the Note of Yehuda was sort of the last functioning rabbi who was the rabbi of a town and who was also a great rabbinic leader, a posek and a functioning rabbi of a town. Yes?
They called it status quo.
No, they were the status quo, right.
Yeah. Yes.
There was the Orthodox, there was the
Noelag,
the Neolog, and the status quo. Right, and the status quo eventually got squeezed out, more or less.
He had Orthodox and status quo school. I went to elementary Orthodox, but the gymnasium and the girls' high school was status quo.
Right. Status quo means the community before the Orthodox movement. The continuation. Remember, all of this was happening in no small part because Hungary was an immigrant community, not much different from various sects that we find in the United States for similar reasons. Okay, so let's read what it says here. I want to spend at least another 10 minutes on the note of Yehuda before getting to some of the other characters in our story. He was endowed with qualities which make him one of the most famous rabbis of the close of the classical Ashkenazi rabbinic era. That is, I would say, pre-Orthodox, status quo. He came from a wealthy and distinguished family tracing its descent back to Rashi. He had a commanding appearance and rare intellectual ability. It was a strong character imbued with a love of truth and of his fellow men, and had considerable diplomatic skill. The author here clearly likes him more than... And so do I, then the author of the Jewish Encyclopedia article.
Which is the new one.
This is the new one.
The new one.
And the others that we're going to discuss are they were contemporary?
Slightly after.
Were they trained to study Yeshiva?
Well, Koren studied in Rabbi Landau's Yeshiva.
He became one of the richest men in Hungary, one of the foreign...
The descendants.
Yeah.
Okay. By nature, he was an intellectual ascetic whose main interests lie in the study and teaching of Torah. In time, he was regarded as the prototype of the ideal Jew. At age 21, he was already Dayan of Brody and at 30, Rabbi of Yampol. From there, he received a call in 1754 to become Rabbi of Prague and the whole of Bohemia, one of the highest positions at that time. His famous proclamation of 1752, whose purpose was to put an end to the notorious Enbin Eibschutz controversy, which split the world into Jewish world into two, helped in no small measure in his obtaining this appointment. His tenure of the Prague rabbinate, a neighbor blonde out of your practical effect to his outstanding